2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, the 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's Lights, Camera, Action with Rush to mark the 5th anniversary of Moving Pictures.
It really was the concept of the album. We looked at all those songs as little films, I think. And we loved the play on words of Moving Pictures and the fact that we were taking a cinematic approach to writing.
Living in the limelight, the universal dream for those who wish to see.
You know, in terms of its effect on our career, I think it really gave us a kind of acceptance and a credibility that none of our records previously had done. I think opened the way for us to be accepted more readily on radio. I don't know, there was just sort of a permanence and legitimacy that came along with the success of that album.
Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush.
Hi, this is Geddy Lee of Rush in the studio for Moving Pictures.
I'm going to defer to AllMusic.com's Greg Prado to set the table for us this time in contexting Rush's February 1981 release, Moving Pictures, about which Prado minces no words. Quote, "Not only is 1981's Moving Pictures Rush's best album, it is undeniably one of the greatest hard rock albums of all time. All 7 of the tracks are classics. The whole entire first side is perfect." Prado concluded, "Rush proved with Moving Pictures that there was still uncharted territory to explore within the hard rock format." End quote. The members of Rush have always been hands-on, totally involved in every aspect of their career, from their many music videos to their tour programs, the design of their stage set, and the cover art for their albums. The cover photo on Moving Pictures is a monument to double or triple meanings. There are workmen actually moving paintings or pictures. Then there are observers crying because the pictures they see are so emotionally moving. And there's a film crew making a moving picture of the whole scene. This album cover was so expensive to stage that the record company back then refused to pay for it, and Rush had to foot the bill. Here's Geddy Lee with me in the studio.
It really was the concept of the album. We looked at all those songs as little films, I think, and we loved the play on words of Moving Pictures and the fact that we were taking a cinematic approach to writing that kind of rock music, which, you know, to many people, I guess, seemed like a kind of silly notion, but to us, it worked. At the same time, we were trying to make these stories that we were telling affecting and emotion, having some kind of emotional impact and moving to the listener. So that was really the inspiration behind the title, and the title really suited what we were trying to accomplish on that record.
A Monday warrior, mean stride, today's Tom Sawyer, mean pride.
Company is what you say about society. Catch the mist, catch the mist. gets high on you, and the space he invades, he gets by on you.
Rush from 1981's Moving Pictures album gave us Tom Sawyer. Rush was a power trio consisting of singer, bass player, keyboard player Geddy Lee, guitarist Alex Lifeson, and drummer, lyricist Neil Peart. They became arena headliners even before Moving Pictures peaked at number 3 on the U.S. Billboard chart, beginning a long succession of million-selling albums in the 80s. But it wasn't always that way. In fact, it took Rush 8 albums to break into the limelight of international success outside of Canada. And don't be misled, their earlier albums 2112 and The Live, All the World's a Stage, those didn't go platinum until after the release of Moving Pictures, which was recorded in the dead of winter 1980 at Les Studios in Montreal. The songs had been written and demos recorded earlier that summer in a converted farmhouse outside of Toronto, owned by Ronnie Hawkins. He's best known for launching the careers of the bands Robbie Robertson and Levon Helm. Once again, here's Geddy Lee of Rush.
But I think it was actually Ronnie Hawkins' farm that we had rented. He had a nice farm, and it was a farmhouse, and the barn was soundproof because I think he used to rehearse with his bands in there. And we set up in the same fashion. We would just hack it out there. We had a lot of different kinds of synthesizers at our disposal, too, which was a new thing, too. I mean, we'd used synthesizers on records previous, but they were making them much smaller, much more portable at that time. So there was a few we'd brought up to the farm with us that we had lying around, and Oberheim was one of the ones we had, and we found this amazing growling sound, which we knew we had to write a song around, and it turned out to be that growling sound that's at the beginning of Tom Sawyer, and really was almost the inspiration for the sound of that song.
Rush had made a deliberate decision to hone their songcraft on their preceding album, Permanent Waves, and the result was their most radio airplay and highest sales to date. Again, Geddy Lee.
our ambitions were getting bigger in one sense, in the way that we eventually thought we could sound. And we suddenly accepted the fact that maybe there are other ways to enhance the sound of our band and other textures that we couldn't ignore from the technology that was growing up around us and existed in other areas of the music world. We were happy with the challenge of being able to write 20-minute pieces and being able to do sidelong works, and we'd done it a number of times by then, and we felt it was almost becoming a cross to bear for us in a way that it was almost limiting us in what we wanted to be. And so we sort of tried to get back to our original desires as songwriters. I think we wanted to become a little more concise and be able to get our ideas across in a more concise and more contemporary manner. Music was changing. Rock music was changing dramatically at that point. There was a lot of bands coming in that were doing things quickly on a low budget and doing things very good, and also doing things that were rhythmically more interesting, and with the influence of reggae and white reggae and, you know, more sort of aggressive punk music that was coming out. And we very much wanted to be part of that. We very much wanted to learn what was going on and reflect the times as opposed to be left behind.
Rush guitarist Alex Lifeson talks with me about the song Red Barchetta.
I remember when the opening keyboard thing went, when we layered it on top, how cool it sounded. And what power and punch the opening had, and the toughness of the way Neil played in that opening, where it's just basically the drums and Getty with the synth rasping away in the background, and then the rest of the band diving into it and screaming all the way through. I always thought that we'd really, again, achieved what we set out to with that song, of having that real punky kind of rebellious attitude to it, that full of abandon. And I think that's what, well, obviously that's what the appeal of the song is. That's what people look for in it, I think.
That was Rush guitarist Alex Lifeson commenting on a futuristic tale of speeding across the countryside in a vintage red Italian sports car from the 20th century in an act of rebellion in a future world where internal combustion engines are outlawed. Next, Rush drummer-lyricist Neil Peart joins Alex Lifeson and Geddy Lee to discuss the profound changes required when living in the limelight. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Rush.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Geddy Lee of Rush.
Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush, in the studio with Redbeard.
Thanks again, gentlemen. It's the anniversary of Rush's most popular album ever, 1981's Moving Pictures. The members of Rush have never been typical rock stars. They're quiet, they're unassuming, highly educated, serious musicians who, much like Pink Floyd, somehow sold millions of albums and concert tickets as an ensemble without really a star frontman. But the back-to-back successes of Permanent Waves and then Moving Pictures was threatening that anonymity, according to Rush singer, bass player, keyboard player Geddy Lee.
Well, Limelight was probably more of Neil's song than a lot of the songs on that album, in the sense that his feelings about being in the limelight and his difficulty with coming to grips with fame and autograph seekers and a sudden lack of privacy and sudden demands on his time, he was having a very difficult time dealing with. I mean, we all were, but I think he was having the most difficulty of the three of us adjusting. And in the sense that, you know, I think he's more sensitive to more things than Alex and I are. You know, it's harder for him to deal with those interruptions on his personal space and his desire to be alone. Being very much a person who needs that solitude, to have someone coming up to you constantly and asking for your autograph is a major interruption in your own little world. Well, I guess in one sense that we're a little bit like misfits in the fact that we've chosen this profession that has all this extreme hype and self-hyping world that we've chosen to live in, and we don't feel comfortable really in that kind of a role.
That's Rush with Limelight, methodically building their own walk of fame beyond the lighted stage, brick by brick, but careful not to trip on the red carpet. Lyricist drummer Neil Peart admitted to me that the back-to-back million-seller successes of Permanent Waves and then Moving Pictures had some unintended, unforeseen consequences.
And each stage of our development has been a real struggle on our part, where we've been holding tenaciously onto our last level. And when we graduated to headlining the small theaters, you know, the vaudeville leftovers and so on, the 3,000, 4,000 seat theaters, we clung to that so tenaciously that we were starting to get so big that we were doing three or four nights in those places, five nights in those kind of theaters. And it just wasn't practical because there were so many other people who weren't getting to see us because we were spending 5 days in one city, you know. And it wasn't fair, really, when you came down to it, that people wanted to see us and couldn't. So you couldn't justify it anymore. You know, we couldn't say it was a compromise. It was a limitation that we faced, that too many people wanted to see us. It's not something we're able to control. So we were pushed into the arenas, basically, by the laws of supply and demand.
Very much like Elton John singing the lyrics of Bernie Taupin, Rush singer Geddy Lee faces an intriguing artistic challenge by virtue of the fact that all Rush lyrics are written by drummer Neil Peart. So I asked singer Geddy how difficult it is to express someone else's thoughts and feelings.
You take two kinds of attitudes when you're a singer, I think. The one is that you write the lyrics or you believe in the lyrics that have been written so strongly that you become the same statement. You have to understand and agree in order to sing it with conviction, I guess is the term I'm looking for. And then there's the other point of view where you look at yourself as an interpreter of someone else's thoughts, and very much like an actor, you know, who takes a screenplay and goes out and he didn't write the words, but he's, to the best of his ability, trying to convey the feelings that person had written. So I think both those things come into play with my role in this band.
The increasingly complex musical arrangements ushered in on the Moving Pictures album would continue to evolve into the rest of the decade, particularly utilizing keyboards to the point where, in concert, Geddy Lee would be forced to play keyboards, play bass pedals with his feet, all the while singing lead vocal. Talk about multitasking. I posed the question to guitarist Alex Lifeson if Rush ever considered adding a fourth member.
I think at that time it was something new for us. We did a lot more on a record than we normally would have, and we were afraid about being true to the record live. So we did talk about it, whether it was time to actually bring somebody on the road. Then decided, no, let's not disrupt anything. We'll work around it somehow, and we did. I tell you, those first 10 days in pre-tour rehearsals, you're going crazy. You know, everything sounds awful. First of all, you sound like a really bad copy band of yourself. Yeah, for starters. And then you've got to remember all the, you know, the pedals and all that stuff. But now, you know, you can read a newspaper while you're doing it, and it's always like that. So I don't think we'd ever actually add somebody live. Plus, being a three-piece for so many years, during a time where keyboards had not evolved, really, synthesizers, right. Which are great space utilizers. They really take up a lot of space in the sound. We always had to do that right from the start. You know, I tended to play a lot of suspended chords, very broad chords, to fill more room. And, you know, the same with Geddy's quick bass playing and Neil's very busy drumming. It just filled more area. So it was a good foundation for us. So I think we can really overcome any kind of obstacle like that. Besides, it's a challenge and it makes things more interesting.
Rush drummer Neil Peart.
Being a trio is something that is special to us, and I think it's special to our fans, too.
It is.
I think if you're a band like Genesis, it's great to have other musicians and works excellently for them, but we are known as a trio. Our reputation has a lot to do with our live show and what the three of us can do live, and we're very proud of what we've been able to stretch a three-piece into being capable of doing.
It's remarkable.
So it's something that is important to us, and and our interrelationship is important to us too. And adding a fourth member on any basis, really, even if you only hire a keyboard player for the tour, it's still someone else that you're traveling with, someone else who is concerned about what you're doing. And we would be very hesitant to play with that because we've seen how difficult it is for other bands to get along. And we know that we are truly one of the few bands who are absolute friends, you know, in the truest sense of that word. We have, I don't think, ever run across another relationship that's like ours. And we're lucky that the songwriting gets divided up equally too, so there aren't political jealousies about whose song gets to be the B-side of the single and the other stuff that a lot of bands go through because they have one good songwriter and the other guys only want the publishing money. For us, we've split the work and we split the rewards, so it eliminates that pressure and it eliminates solo albums and it eliminates somebody quitting the band for so-called musical differences. All of that stuff, you know, it's right out. So we're lucky.
Ambitious Witch Hunt from Rush, conceived as one part of a trilogy called Fear, spread over three separate albums. In spite of its ominous tone, guitarist Alex Lifeson remembers the recording of Witch Hunt of the so-called mob scene for the song's intro.
We had a riot, as a matter of fact, doing the opening where you have the scary piano part and the mob ranting and raving.
we went outside the studio, and it was so cold. It was really cold. We were well into December then, I think. We were all out there, and we put a couple of mics outside, and we started, you know, ranting and raving. We did a couple of tracks of that, and we had, I think we had a bottle of scotch or something with us to keep us warm. So as the contents of the bottle became less and less, the ranting and raving took on a different flavor, and you got little lines of, you remember Roger Ramjet, the cartoon Roger Ramjet? And what was the bad guy's name? His gang of hoods. They always had these little things that they would say whenever they were mumbling. Blue Cross. And it started to take all this. We were sitting in the control room after we laid down about 12 tracks of Mob in hysterics. Every once in a while, you'd hear somebody say something really stupid. It would come in and out against this backdrop of very tense atmospheric music. It was a lot of fun. It was one of the high points, actually, of the recording session, which, by the way, was probably one of the greatest times that we'd had in the studio up until the last couple records. It was very enjoyable making Moving Pictures. It flowed. Everything sounded good. The vibe was good. Everybody was in great spirits during the whole process. And usually recording at that time or through the early years was tedious, very hard work.
Still to come, Alex Lifeson, Geddy Lee, and Neil Peart assess the Moving Pictures album, and we'll check the band's vital signs. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Alex Lifeson, Geddy Lee, and In the Studio on the anniversary of Rush's Moving Pictures.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Geddy Lee of Rush.
Hi, this is Alex Lifeson of Rush in the studio with Redbeard.
Thanks again, guys. By the time of 1981's Moving Pictures album, Rush had eschewed the epic-length, fantasy-laden compositions in favor of shorter songs with varied lyrical themes from drummer Neil Peart.
I try to cover everybody. No, I really do. I look inside myself, and I look at my friends. I look at my family. I look at the people that work for us. I look at our audience. I look at the cities we travel through, people I see on planes, people in Europe. I mean, it's limitless, really, and try to get inside their lives a little bit sometimes. I can see an incident, or I can see a particular interplay between people, and it will suggest a universal thing, and that's what's important. And when I look inside myself, I don't ever want to write introspective lyrics, because I think that's immoral, or there's something wrong with that, looking inside and writing about myself, you know, and I try never to do that. But if I can find something in myself and see it again in my friends, or maybe see it in our audience, or see it somewhere else in the world, then that I want to have, you know, a thing that I have in common, perhaps a parallel that I can draw between my experience and other people's, or issues that affect us all, too. You know, there's things that you read in the paper, things that you see in the news that are really outrageous. And in the course of everyday life, it's so easy to forget them. You know, you can watch all those people get murdered. And at the time, everybody in the world is outraged, and all the people on the street give their little speech on TV and the news, you know. And then they go home to the pressures of their lives, and they have to get up and go to work the next day, and their boss is hassling them. And all these realities of life that should not and cannot be denigrated. I mean, I know how large they loom in your life when you're subject to them. But at the same time, you can't afford to forget about the big things, you know. And it's an issue that I've made over and over again. And going back to a line in Natural Science, it reminds me of that. Living in their pools, people forget about the sea. It was the analogy then about tide pools, where small aquatic life get washed up into little tide pools, and then the tide goes out, and for them the world suddenly becomes that tiny little area. And for people it is that way too. You know, their town or their city is the universe, and they judge what's happening by that. And it's everywhere. I mean, you see that kind of provincialism in America, in Canada, in Western Europe, all over the place, where it's shocking to someone who travels as much as I do and sees everybody's troubles, you know, not just one city's or one state's. I look at them all and hear about them all, so consequently it's impossible for me to take that narrow of a view. But at the same time, I have friends who are unemployed, and I have friends who are having difficulties in their lives, so I want that to come out too.
A symptom of life.
Vital Signs for Moving Pictures is an example of the modern rock and reggae sounds that Rush assimilated successfully into their sound on that album. Guitarist Alex Lifeson explains the importance of moving pictures.
I guess it allowed us to keep making records that much longer. I mean, we renegotiated our record deal on the strength of that record. So that automatically added on to our longevity. We knew that we had the budget for so many albums for the next 8 or 10 years or whatever. So in that way, it guaranteed us that freedom to make whatever records we wanted to make and to, I guess, instill some confidence in the record company that we were capable of making records that they could be commercially happy with, which is not a big priority with us, believe me. The artistic end of the album is what's most important.
Rush singer and bass player Geddy Lee assesses the album Moving Pictures.
It really cemented our career and guaranteed a kind of longevity that we've had since. I mean, it was tremendously well received, and even to this day is, I don't think, ever stopped selling. And it was a culmination of so many things for us, so many of the experiments musically and the discussions and the honing of our craft, I guess. A lot of those things came together for us on that record. You know, it was a record that we were always very proud of and very proud to tour. You know, in terms of its effect on our career, I think it really gave us a kind of acceptance and a credibility that none of our records previously had done. I think opened the way for us to be accepted more readily on radio. I don't know, there was just sort of a permanence and legitimacy that came along with the success of that album.
This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guests, Geddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, and Neil Peart. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and inthestudio.net.